Today is November the 28th, 2018. Black Friday and Cyber Monday has come and gone, but guess what? The period of all these sales are still called Black Friday and Cyber Monday, and they're still available. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm on the internet, and our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. The retroevolution of the Apple iPhone models. Taking a look back at another week of news from Cupertino, Apple cuts iPhone XR pricing and the return of the iPhone X. According to Forbes News, lots of attention has been placed on the failing sales of the 2018 iPhone handsets. Although Apple has decided it is no longer reporting sales, there are enough indicators from the supply chain to illustrate the downward trend on the expected iPhone sales. It's a scary outlook for Apple on the surface. Apple has already stated that it will no longer be offering sales figures for the iPhone. Instead, focusing on the software and services side of Apple in the near future. With the increased retail price of the leading iPhones and the increasing margin of the devices further down the portfolio, it's likely that Apple's revenue and profit will remain high. Alongside the falling numbers in the supply chain, Apple is cutting the wholesale cost of the iPhone in Japan. By offering larger subsidies, the hope must be that carriers would put more effort into selling the newer handset thanks to the larger margins. Apple is set to lower prices of the iPhone XR in Japan by offering subsidies to Japanese carriers. The price drops are apparently going into effect as soon as possible. The $750 price is, well, somewhat disguised in Japan due to bundle carrier contracts. But the device is seemingly being overshadowed by the still popular iPhone 8 in the region. Coupled with the lower sales of the iPhone XS and XS Max, and a potential commitment to Samsung to purchase a certain number of OLED screens, Apple has increased production of the iPhone X as reported by the Wall Street Journal, a handset that was effectively discontinued in Apple stores with the launch of the 2018 family of handsets. The move is allegedly due to an agreement made with Samsung to purchase a certain quantity of OLED screens. With this year's OLED-equipped models failing to sell at the quantities needed to fulfill the terms of the deal, the report suggests that Apple is turning to last year's model for a solution. Apple ceased selling the iPhone X in stores when the XS was first released. The iPhone X is thought to be cheaper to produce than the XS or XS Max thanks to its age, which means components and manufacturing equipment is cheaper, according to the Wall Street Journal. In the past, legacy models have been produced when there's enough demand for them in certain markets. Is the Apple Store a monopoly? Anyone who wants to get an app for an iPhone has only one place to go: Apple's own App Store. The U.S. Supreme Court heard argument this Monday on whether customers can sue by claiming that such an arrangement amounts to a monopoly that jacks up prices. If the justices allow the case to go forward in the lower courts and Apple eventually loses, that could disrupt the App Store, even though the average price of an app is just over $1. The App Store generated an estimated $11 billion in revenue for the company last year. A ruling that Apple was running an illegal monopoly could expose it to millions of dollars in damages. Software developers say that outcome would disrupt similar online marketplaces that operate between app creators and customers. But some consumer groups say it could create competition that would lower prices. Apple urges the Supreme Court to throw the case out, arguing that it's not actually selling anything, but is instead operating a marketplace that allows app developers to sell their products. A key question is, who's responsible for any overcharging? The developers, who set the price, or Apple, who levies a commission on every app sold? Apple iPhones are designed to run only programs sold through its App Store. When software developers offer their products, Apple reviews them for compatibility and malware, and once they are approved, charges the developer a 30% commission. When a customer buys an app, Apple collects the purchase price, if any, and sends the proceeds to the developer. But a group of iPhone customers filed a class action lawsuit claiming that Apple has created a closed market for apps, closing the company to tack on a monopoly overcharge to every sale. Apple's intentionally closed system prevents competition. A lawyer representing the customer said, which enables the App Store to collect a higher price than if Apple were forced to entice app seekers in a competitive market. If the customers succeed in their lawsuit, it could be a big payday. Antitrust law allows huge damages. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments for a lawsuit brought against Apple over how it handles App Store sales. So far, Supreme Court justices seem to be leaning in favor of consumers and not Apple. Here is some background on the case. The antitrust lawsuit dates back to 2011 and alleges that Apple has created a monopoly by only allowing apps to be sold through its first-party app store. In turn, the suit also says Apple uses that monopoly to charge excessive commissions. For its part, Apple claims it's more of a middleman between consumers and app developers than a distributor. Apple argues that it's only acting as an agent for developers who sell to consumers via the App Store, not a distributor. Some recent cases have been ruled in favor of companies, like the Supreme Court throwing out a lawsuit against American Express that alleged anti-competitive practices via Bloomberg. However, Reuters reports that the Supreme Court justices may be leaning towards siding with customers. A final ruling on the case isn't expected until June of next year. An update. The Supreme Court justices signal sympathy for consumers suing Apple in antitrust dispute over the App Store. The U.S. Supreme Court justices appeared open to letting a proposed class action lawsuit proceed against Apple that accuses the company of operating an illegal App Store monopoly. The lawsuit was filed in 2011 by a group of iPhone users who believe Apple violates federal antitrust laws by requiring apps to be sold through its App Store, where it collects a 30% commission from all purchases, leading to inflated prices as developers pass on the cost of the commission to customers. The bottom line is that iPhone users believe that apps would be priced lower outside of the App Store, as Apple's 30% cut would not be baked into its price. The lawsuit was initially dismissed in 2013 by a California district court due to errors in the complaint, but the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit revived the case in 2017. Apple appealed with the Supreme Court, which will rule whether the case should proceed after hearing an hour of arguments today. From the start, Apple has argued that it doesn't set prices for paid apps and that charging a 30% commission on the distribution of paid apps and in-app purchases does not violate antitrust laws in the United States. Last year, the Justice Department filed an amicus brief in support of Apple. The plaintiffs, meanwhile, are backed by 30 state attorney generals, including those representing Texas, California, and New York. The Supreme Court is expected to make a ruling by June of next year. Stay tuned. The United States Supreme Court's Internet Sales Tax Ruling. In the wake of the Supreme Court ruling, e-commerce companies are understandably both concerned and uncertain of their future. The 5-4 verdict overruled a 1992 precedent set by the case Quill v. North Dakota that only addressed mail-order businesses at the time. But it became a powerful legal bedrock for the e-commerce industry. It let companies without a robust physical infrastructure thrive during and after the dot-com boom by exempting purchases from sales tax, so long as the seller did not have a physical operation in the state where the customer resided. Now, following the court's decision, states can start charging sales tax on internet purchases even when a retailer has no physical presence in that state. A number of retailers may be impacted. It's not necessarily because those corporations have been skirting sales tax collection, but some enable thousands of third-party sellers to do so, largely thanks to Quill versus North Dakota. In fact, Amazon, which last year started collecting sales tax in all 45 states that require it by law, may have a substantial amount of work to do to help its Amazon Marketplace sellers to stay compliant. Yet we don't know if that burden will fall primarily on Amazon or will it be the responsibility of the sellers. More than 50% of all sales on the site are conducted via third-party sellers, some of which use Amazon for fulfillment, but otherwise operate independent small to medium-sized businesses. A few Chinese companies have thousands of employees and an international footprint, suggesting that the ruling could alter the price of popular products on Amazon and how Chinese companies are able to operate in the United States. Etsy, that's E-T-S-Y, eBay and others are in similar boats. According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, as much as $13 billion in annual sales tax revenue is at stake. Amazon did not comment, nor did it release a statement on the ruling. But Etsy CEO said, while today's decision is not the one for which we advocated, the Supreme Court did acknowledge the important difference between big internet retailers and the creative entrepreneurs on our platform. Etsy is concerned about what it sees as significant complexities in the thousands of state and local sales tax laws, and that by overruling the Quill decision, the Supreme Court has put the ball in Congress's court. We believe there is now a call to action for Congress to create a simple, fair, federal solution for microbusinesses. eBay echoed those same sentiments, as expressed in both the Supreme Court's decision and throughout oral arguments. The operations of small businesses are different from large retailers, and state tax actions targeting them raise additional legal questions that are not addressed by this decision. eBay wrote in a statement, "Now is the time for Congress to step in and provide clear tax rules with a strong small business exemption to help small businesses take advantage of the internet to grow and create local jobs." For the online businesses specifically cited in the case, Newegg, Overstock, and Wayfair, the ruling has been met with more pushback and calls for congressional action. Wayfair, in a statement, says it already collects sales tax on about 80% of all sales, and that it has long supported a legislative solution that would establish a level playing field for brick-and-mortar and online retailers. Yet while the decision was not the ideal venue for creating the level playing field, Wayfair hopes for more clarity on the issue down the line. Overstock, which like Wayfair and Amazon Marketplace, lets third-party companies sell on its website. Unless Congress responds, the court's ruling may remove key entrepreneurial opportunities before they even get out of the heads of the inventors. At the heart of the matter is how the ruling will be clarified in further litigation and what exemptions there may be for small businesses now that the Supreme Court has bounced the decision back to the lower courts. Because the Supreme Court simply overruled the Quill decision and did not make constitutional the South Dakota law that initially raised the issue, the case may be litigated for years to come to figure out how to account for over 10,000 state jurisdictions that govern sales tax across the country. That is, unless congressional legislation supersedes the state court decisions. Notably, the South Dakota law that kicked off the debate put in a $100,000 annual sales threshold, or in the absence of that, a $200 in-state transaction limit. That's a threshold so low it would sweep in all but the very tiniest of online retailers. Litigations would begin immediately, state by state, over how small is too small. There is only one alternative to waiting years for the courts to resolve these questions: federal legislation. Congress is far more capable of resolving highly fact-dependent policy questions than the courts. A large part of the issue is not just that there are so many jurisdictions involved around the country that may make operating a small business that engages in interstate commerce exceedingly complicated. It is also that within those jurisdictions, certain products may be taxed differently depending on minute differences, like whether the product contains a certain ingredient. As Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his dissenting opinion, items like deodorant with antiperspirant are taxed in Texas at a rate of 6.25%, while deodorant without antiperspirant is not taxed at all, and yarn sold to residents of New Jersey exempt from sales tax so long as it is designated as yarn for sweaters and not another type of fabric-based product. Even groups that were in favor of the ruling, like the Nonpartisan Research Institute, the Information Technology and Information Foundation, are imploring Congress to act. This ruling ensures that major online businesses cannot operate as virtual sales tax havens, allowing consumers to avoid paying their fair share of sales tax and unfairly competing with other online brick-and-mortar retailers. The ruling is the right step forward for the digital economy, and e-commerce has grown up. States have a history of enacting laws and regulations that discriminate against online businesses to boost local businesses. Congress should resist any attempts by states to place undue burdens on e-commerce, so as to protect both small businesses and the consumers who would largely suffer from higher prices placed on products in the event of high sales tax sales and burdensome compliance costs. It's too early to tell exactly how this will shake out across the country, and for businesses as large and complex as Amazon, Etsy, eBay, and many other product-specific sites modeled like those marketplaces. But it's clear that in paving the way for states to modernize their approaches to internet sales tax, grave consequences exist for both consumer and businesses in the absence of sensible legislation. The Supreme Court, in its majority opinion, assumes software tools, similar to an existing one Amazon offers its marketplace sellers, will step in to help simplify tax collection and the other cumbersome tasks that may arise as ripple effects of the ruling. But those tools don't yet exist. In the meantime, everyone is left scratching their heads and looking to an increasingly gridlocked Congress for answers. A historical space flight. NASA's InSight spacecraft lands successfully on Mars after a 300 million mile journey. After nearly 7 months and more than 300 million miles of travel, NASA's InSight spacecraft touched down on Mars on Monday to cheers. The landing was suspenseful as the robot rapidly decelerated from 12,300 to 5 miles per hour. This is NASA's first such landing attempt on the Red Planet in 6 years. Since 1960, various national space agencies have made 44 similar attempts to land on Mars, but only 18 of those were completely successful, according to NASA. Once on Mars, InSight will drill into the ground with a probe to offer mankind a first-ever look inside the Red Planet. We've studied Mars from orbit and from the surface since 1965, learning about its weather, atmosphere, geology, and surface chemistry. Now we finally will explore inside Mars and deepen our understanding of our terrestrial neighbor as NASA prepares to send human explorers deeper into the solar system. It was spellbinding, listening to Mission Control count down to the expected landing of the Mars InSight lander. When it got down to about 50 feet before landing, there was a long silence of 15 seconds. You could see that everyone was holding their breath. Then it was announced the Mars InSight lander had landed, and there erupted a loud emotional cheer. The following is an audio recording of that.
Radio Science reports sudden change in Doppler.
Ground stations are observing signals consistent with parachute deploy.
Marco Alpha, Marco Bravo, maintain lock status.
Telemetry shows parachute deployment. Radar powered on. Heat shield separation commanded.
This is really good news so far.
That's fantastic.
I'm on pins and needles.
We have radar activation where the radar is beginning to search for the ground. Once the radar locks on the ground and InSight is about 1 kilometer above the surface, the lander will separate from the back shell and begin terminal descent using its 12 descent engines. Altitude convergence, the radar has locked on the ground.
Yes.
Standing by for lander separation.
Carrier interruption on Marco Alpha and Marco Bravo.
Lander separation commanded. Altitude 600 meters. Gravity turn, altitude 400 meters.
We're getting there.
300 meters. 200 meters. 80 meters. 60 meters. 50 meters, constant velocity. 37 meters. 30 meters. 20 meters, 17 meters, standing by for touchdown. Touchdown confirmed.
More than 500,000 users have installed Android malware posing as driving games from Google's own App Store. A researcher at ESET tweeted the details of 13 gaming apps made by the same developer, which were, at the time of his tweet, downloadable from Google Play. Two of the apps were trending on the store, he said, giving the apps greater visibility. Combined, the apps surpassed 580,000 installs before Google pulled the plug. Anyone downloading the apps were expecting a truck or car driving game, and instead they got what appeared to be a buggy app that crashed every time it opened. In reality, the app was downloading a payload from another domain, registered to an app developer in Istanbul, and installed malware behind the scenes, deleting the app's icon in the process. It's not clear exactly what the malicious apps do. None of the malware scanners seem to agree on what the malware does, based on the uploaded sample to VirusTotal. What is clear that the malware has persistence, launching every time the Android phone or tablet is started up, and has full access to its network traffic, which the malware author can use to steal secrets. The Istanbul domain owner, Mert Ozek, and he did not respond to any of the queries from the United States. So if you downloaded any of these drivable programs, delete it, check your system, clean it out, and if you didn't, consider yourself fortunate. MIT engineers flew a Star Trek-inspired plane without any moving parts. Inspired by Star Trek, researchers from MIT have successfully demonstrated that a plane can fly silently using ionic wind without needing any moving parts such as propellers, turbine blades, and fans. Ionic wind is based on the principle that a wind is generated in the air between two electrodes when current passes between them. When enough voltage is applied, a thrust can be produced with the ionic wind to power a small plane without the need for any moving parts. The phenomenon was first identified in the 1920s, but it's only just been applied successfully in avionics. In the model drone used for the study, the front portion of the wing produces enough of an electrical field in a portion called the emitters to ionize air, removing the electrons from the air molecules, thus charging them and creating positively charged ions. These ions are attracted to negatively charged structures on the plane's other end called collectors. When the ions move to the collectors, they collide with the air molecules and transfer energy to them, creating a flow of air that thrusts the plane in the opposite direction. It's worth noting that this model does not seem easily scalable to a large aircraft. The MIT team's model drone could convert only 2.6% of the input energy into thrust. A large part of the success was due to the team's computer-aided design approach and the decision to use super lightweight building materials such as carbon fiber, balsa wood, and the plastic core polystyrene, shrink-wrap plastic, and Kevlar, none of which are ideal for building any sturdy commercial airplanes. The current design was arrived after trial and error with models of varying weights, wingspan, and energy for thrust. What they developed was a drone with a wingspan of 16.4 feet wide with a total weight of 5.5 pounds, and it was a multi-decker craft that flew after a few forced starts, but only for 10 seconds. The team was limited by the length of their testing room, but the demonstration was enough of a proof of concept that ionic drive can sustain flight significantly longer than it's possible with just gliding. This is far from any practical implementation. The result of the test flight was published in the science journal Nature. Well, maybe in my lifetime we'll be able to have a plane that can fly without any moving parts, but I'm not holding my breath. Dr. Alfred Poor has a presentation on Google Pulls Plug on Smart Contact Lens Project. He'll also talk about artificial intelligence and smart stethoscope detecting heart disease, and a flexible supercapacitor can be sewn directly into smart garments.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
It's a cold, hard fact of the technology world that not all projects make it to the sales counter. Not even all the good ones. Not even all the ones that are good and have lots of publicity. Sometimes they make it, but most of them fail. And we don't focus a lot here on Health Tech Insider on the ones that don't make it, but every once in a while there's a story that really deserves some attention because of all the attention it received at the beginning. And now that we've reached the end, it deserves some attention now. And the project that I'm talking about is one that was developed by the division of Alphabet. Alphabet, as you may recognize, is the parent company of Google. Well, Alphabet also has a division called Verily. And years ago, they started developing a smart contact lens, a lens that had sensors built in and controllers, and the goal was that it would be able to wirelessly communicate with another device to send biometric data. The goal was that it would be able to detect glucose levels in the tears of the subject, then forward them to a device so that you could monitor your glucose levels and maintain your insulin doses without having to do a finger prick, a non-invasive, easy way to track your blood sugar level. Well, that was announced about 4 years ago in 2014, and it was one of Google Health's big initial projects and received a whole lot of attention at the time. The Verily division has announced that they're pulling the plug on the project. They're not going to be able to make it work. And one of the reasons is they've discovered that tears just aren't a reliable source of glucose information. This is something that a number of scientists have believed to be the case for many, many years, which was one of the major sources of skepticism about whether or not this project ever would come to market. But as it turns out, it's just too difficult for them to infer reliably what's going on in your blood based on what's in your tears. And so this project is probably a dead end. Don't expect to hear a lot more about it in the future. Some of the stuff that was developed is going to continue. There is going to be work on miniaturized glucose sensors, and they're going to keep working on a smart lens program. As far as a non-invasive contact lens that's going to measure your glucose levels, that's probably never going to happen. There's a group of different heart diseases that all focus around the problem of the heart not being able to pump enough blood. Heart failure is one of the most familiar, but there are other conditions as well. One of the problems is diagnosing this problem. The typical way of doing it is using something that's called an echocardiogram. This is an expensive procedure and takes a lot of time and requires a skilled technician and cardiologist to interpret the results. However, there's a move on to help screen patients earlier by primary care physicians that will help determine whether a patient has or is likely to develop this sort of heart failure condition. The project that's underway right now is a collaboration between ECHO, which makes smart stethoscopes for physicians, and the Mayo Clinic. Now, the interesting thing is that ECHO has a digital stethoscope that not only digitizes the sound of the heartbeat, but it also acts as a one-lead ECG, an electrocardiogram. So it actually shows the waveform of the heartbeat, the electrical impulse. And the sound and the electrical waveform together provide more data than either one by themselves. And this correlation of data is making it possible to identify potential heart problems earlier on. The fascinating thing is that the partnership with Mayo Clinic has given the company access to millions of electrocardiogram records from the Mayo Clinic records. This has then been able to be used for training an artificial intelligence learning system to look for correlations and to be able to interpret these heart data that you get from the sound and the electrical impulse. And the result is they're come up with a system that appears to be able to identify not just people with heart failure, but also people who are likely to develop the condition in a short time frame. So this is a new technology. It's a new way of using artificial intelligence, and it could be a way to help keep people healthier a lot longer. As we've reported here many times, one of the problems with wearable devices is that you have to get power to them. And we want to have our wearable health tech devices disappear into our lives so we don't have to think about them, don't have to think about putting them on, don't have to think about charging them. Well, there's a new development coming out of the University of Massachusetts. They have a wearable electronics lab, and they've created a new power source for wearable sensors and other devices that can be incorporated directly into a garment. What it is a supercapacitor. A supercapacitor holds more energy per unit than a standard battery does. This particular design is flexible and durable, but the cool thing about it is it's on a plastic substrate, and it is able to be sewn directly into the fabric of the smart garment. So this is a possible future for smart clothing to be able to power the sensors and other devices that we'll want to have incorporated in them, and a good alternative to batteries. So we hope to see this come out of the labs and make it into our clothing.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. From the Tech Corner, I'm going to be talking about Windows 7 and 8.1. Well, they're still alive and kicking as Microsoft releases Windows 7 and 8.1 cumulative updates. I was recently asked by a good friend to reinstall Windows 7 back onto his machine. He had a pop-up on the screen that misled him that there was an important message from the bank regarding his account. He was asked to click onto a more information to follow. It was a message for him to call a certain telephone number, demanding a certain payment if he wants to continue to use the system. He turned off the machine but was unable to boot up the machine. He brought the system over to me to see if I could help. I tried to reinstall Windows 7 from his hidden partition. The physical drive was corrupted. I reformatted the hard disk drive on his system and reinstalled Windows 7 from a Windows 7 distribution and used the product code that was affixed to the bottom of his laptop. Fortunately, he did backups on a regular schedule. He used a system for online transactions and shopping on the internet, so there was no important applications to really reinstall. I used a version of Windows 7 that I had integrated, SP1, which is Service Pack 1, but there were 186 Windows updates to reinstall. It took many hours. I had asked him before I did the updates if he wanted Windows 7 to be upgraded to Windows 10, as I have Windows 10 build 1507 to upgrade Windows 7 to 10 for free. He declined as it meant a new learning curve, and he did not feel comfortable learning the navigation of a new operating system, and he just wanted to get back on with his banking transactions. Windows 7 accounts for over 36% of the installed base of Windows operating systems today. Windows 10, which was introduced in July of 2015, has an installed base of 52%. So there is some good news for those still on Windows 7. And also, by the way, Windows 8.1. After releasing cumulative updates for all supported versions of Windows 10, Microsoft has also released a new patch for Windows 7 and 8.1 with updated security and general fixes. If you have to reinstall Windows 7, Microsoft releases 7 and 8.1 cumulative updates, which are, and I'll try to repeat this again, are now available. For Windows 7, KB4467107. Windows 7 cumulative update is KB4467107. And the cumulative updates for 8.1 is KB4467697. That's KB4467697. These updates, KB4467107 for Windows 7 and KB4467697 for Windows 8.1 comes with general bug fixes, and you can grab the updates by checking for updates in Control Panel. Alternatively, you can also install them manually by downloading the package from the Microsoft Update Catalog website, which is www.catalog.update.microsoft.com. I'll repeat that again. The Microsoft Update Catalog website is www.catalog.update.microsoft.com. KB4467107 for Windows 7 includes the following fixes: security updates for Windows app platform and frameworks, Windows graphics, Windows wireless networking, Windows kernel, and Windows server. Microsoft is aware of only one issue today, and there's a workaround for it. And I'll have Michael, our webmaster, post these on our website, pcradioshow.org. Microsoft is not aware of any known issues in today's cumulative updates for Windows 8.1. So the good news is, instead of spending many hours doing the update of 186 patches to reinstall Windows 7, is one cumulative update, you could just get it running and it will be done in much quicker time. The problem with the 186 patches is that we're patches that patch the patches. And of course, you're doing redundant work and it takes a long time. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping on your nose. Marty has his eyes all aglow as he is busy with making the season bright. Marty, tell us how you're making the house warm and comfortable so you don't have to dress up like an Eskimo.
Think about this. What if, for some reason, you couldn't see out any of your windows, as if something outside were black, tightly covering your view? Now, ignoring the calendar, what is there anywhere inside the house that would let you know whether or not it's winter outside? Are the walls cold, or the floors, the window panes? Is there cold air coming through the fireplace or the exhaust vent? Is the house starting to get that absolutely not fresh air aroma? Does anything seem slower about the way that water flows from the faucets or the shower? Or how about how quickly water drains down the sinks or the tub? Is the laundry taking longer? Is there static on your rugs or your clothing? Is your notebook misbehaving? How about your handsets? That's quite a list of symptoms, I know. And they're part of cause and effect relationships that I hope to explain, well, in a few minutes. First, though, I should probably address cause and effect relationships, because way too often we tend to link unrelated things as if they were in that kind of relationship. Let me give you an almost funny example. Is anybody you know bald? I can tell you about something that you can buy at any grocery store. I am absolutely not suggesting any cause and effect relationship here. But many who drink it daily go from bald to a long-term full head of hair in less than 2 months. It's called infant formula. There are a lot of assumptions and presumptions about cause and effect, and sometimes stating them backwards is so obvious it's almost funny. Well, almost. Want to live forever? Don't die. Want to be the wealthiest, smartest, and best-looking person in the entire world? Either kill everybody else or move to an unpopulated world. Almost funny, but not quite. So, let's get real with winter. What can we directly observe about it? Let's agree on some stipulations, okay? First, we're talking about circumstances where and when it's a lot colder outside than the rest of the year. Second, we'll allow that the presence from time to time of snow and ice outside is not at all unlikely. Now, we can let science connect a few dots. Because it's colder, the air will hold less humidity. It will be drier. Because the air is dry, static electricity is more likely to manifest. Those things are old school to everybody, but some connections are hiding another level or so deeper. We're forced to be analytical, to think like detectives. We need to be Sherlock Holmes to take a sure look at our homes and what they're telling us about the winter wickedness with which they're being beset. The game is afoot, and afoot is a good way to step into the game. Are the floors warm, cold, or neutral to your bare feet? We're not talking about what's normal for the flooring materials. We know that carpet and many natural woods will always feel warmer than tile or linoleum or manufactured flooring. But if the floors feel colder than they did, say, 6 months ago, there's something amiss. I'm not a purist. If you want to say that something is sending cold through the floor, you can. I won't insist on saying, oh, dearie me, the proper term is thermal conduction of warmth creating an exothermal effect. Cold is the effect. What's the cause? Whatever the cause, it's originating from the other side of the flooring. So the question is, what lies below? If it's a slab, just a plain concrete slab, there are a few things you can do, but they may not be worth it. The slab is in direct thermal contact with the ground below it and the subflooring above. You could potentially tear up your flooring, replace the subflooring with something that insulates better, and then restore your flooring. But it's almost certainly smarter to just invest in slipper socks. If it's a crawl space, get down there with an expert, or have the expert go down there without you. It's possible that something like closed-cell polyurethane foam could get sprayed all over at the top of the crawl space, which is the underside of the floor, and on the bottom of the crawl space and on the crawl space walls. Without that kind of treatment, the floor is just a great big heat sink that draws all the heat out of your feet. The extra insulation breaks up that thermal path. It will make the floor less cold. If it's a basement down there, is it usable in the winter? Is it too cold to be comfortable? If it were comfortable, would you be using it, or has it become just a dump for all the stuff you're saving for later? We're just past Thanksgiving, so I won't call it hoarding. Anyway, if it's a place you'd use more if it were more comfortable, that's absolutely worth addressing. It wouldn't be efficient to just plug in a space heater. The better plan is to look at the six sides of the box that is your basement. Is it finished? What's behind the walls? What's on the floor? How about the ceiling? The very most effective thing you can do will shrink that box by about a foot and a half wall to wall with a layer of that closed cell foam behind the wallboards and replacing the wallboards with some of the thermally insulated wallboard that's available these days. If you can't handle the shrinking box, then use some of that fluffy fiberglass roll stuff behind thermal wallboard. Ask a flooring expert about layered subflooring with enhanced thermal insulating qualities. Don't sweat the ceiling right now. Is your basement unfinished? It's the same kind of exercise, except that your flooring and paneling will be all new. Just don't expect too much from them without attention to the insulation on the walls and underfoot. Let's get back to the floor that feels cold to bare feet when it's on the second floor or higher. If the first floor, or whatever floor is just below, is comfortable, figure out if the floor really does feel too cold instead of just slightly cool. Then remember, hot air rises, cold air falls. In this case, it falls to the floor, where it makes the floor a little colder. You need to find out where that air is coming from. One of the most likely places is the window frame. It may be worth it to go back to my segment from the October 24th show, the week before Halloween, where I go into a lot of details about windows and window frames and so on. It could also be that water is getting into the flooring, which is likely if your house is coping with ice dams or if there is a plumbing leak. Are the walls cold? Most houses are built with only so-so insulation, which can be expensive to buttress after the fact. Again, it means tearing out the existing wallboard, putting better insulation behind it, and replacing it with a thermal wallboard, which also means repainting or repapering. Or, again, the windows or window frames may be a factor. I told you about insulated double-wall flexible round ductwork in an earlier episode or an earlier segment. Replacing your existing ducts with that will all by itself deliver more air with less heat loss. Then again, it could be coming down from the attic or higher. Is there a bathroom with an exhaust fan? When the fan isn't running, is cold air coming down out of its housing? Is there any insulation at all between the attic floor and the rooms below, or between the attic ceiling and the roof above? If you're wondering where the cold could be coming from, these are very popular paths. The same is true for the exhaust hood over your stove. Ask a ventilation pro about automatic dampers to control that, and have a fireplace guy check your flue for full closure. Okay, let's take a breather, unless you really don't like breathing your indoor air. Winters are when you want to keep your house closed up, when you don't want to open the windows to get some fresh air, when you scuttle through the outside doors as rapidly as possible, and that's not all. It's also when you spend the least time outdoors, in part because of the weather, but also in part because it gets dark so early. So, the activities you tend to do and the time you tend to spend doing them are indoors. Bodily outgassing through breathing, burping, or their more malodorous counterpart happen indoors, and you may not feel sweaty, but you still sweat. You cook indoors. Got pets? All of these fragrances mix with the air in ever-increasing concentrations. If your house has an attic ridge vent, chances are that snow is blocking it. Forced air exchange systems are a better answer, and again, talk to an HVAC expert you trust. If you smell something worse, like mold or mildew, jump on that right away before it can impact the health of your family members. At the same time that you remediate the symptom, meaning the places where the mold and mildew are growing, do whatever it takes to remove the cause. Ice dams may be the reason, but don't forget, freezing temperatures can also wreak havoc with plumbing. Metal pipes and plastic pipes can both encounter problems. PEX piping tends not to. Mold and mildew start with a source of wetness. Find it and kill it. Freezing can also cause breaks or disruptions in drain lines. I never met a plumber who couldn't track that down pretty quickly. You'll want that. Drain line leaks within or under your structure can lead to massive expenses that are usually avoidable if you nip them in the bud. So let's head to the land of sparks and arcs. Static electricity isn't just about doorknob flashes or other little zaps. There can be bigger zaps, big enough to disrupt what you're doing on a smartphone or tablet, big enough to make a PC queasy. There are three things you can do. First, a whole house humidifier or cool mist room humidifiers can make those sparks a lot less likely. We've heard that aerosol fabric softener on carpets around computers can also help, but I never personally tried confirming that. Second, get yourself surge protectors. It's not overreacting to have an electrician install a whole house surge protector at the breaker box. And certainly, each computer should plug into one, as should cable modems, routers, TV sets, and audio gear. Most UPS gear has built-in surge protection. Of course, the best protection is even more thorough. Backing up power and backing up data and keeping a backup of your backup in some safe other place. The temperature may be dropping, but there's no reduction in your need to backup.
Thank you, Marty. It's so nice to hear you are converting your man cave into a she shed for your wife as a Christmas gift. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Brookdale Computer Users Group, known as BCUG, has a presentation on current trends in personal technology Thursday, November the 29th at 7 p.m. They meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society, known as DACS, D-A-C-S, has a meeting Tuesday, December the 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Location is Danbury Hospital, Creasy Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computing Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on new technology toys for the holidays, Tuesday, December the 4th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m. They meet at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their general meeting December the 7th. Meeting time, 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 411, and that's located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 14th. They meet at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus at Old Westbury, New York. If you have any club meetings you want me to announce on your behalf on the air, send me a note. My address is hankkey@pcradioshow.org. We like to hear from you, and if you have any computer-related questions or comments, drop us a line at hankkey@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on prn.fm on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the internet at that time. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and to paraphrase a noted Yuletide song, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, and so I'm offering this simple phrase, to kids from 1 to 92, although it's been said many times in many ways, back up, and back up your system. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.